Blog Talk Radio.
Today on Backroom Politics, breaking news out of the great state of Michigan. Michigan becomes the 24th state to invoke right to work. Also, the fiscal cliff looms. We are T-minus 10 days in counting from the actual going over the cliff. Senator Jim DeMint decides to call it a day in the Senate. And GOP infighting. Is this a problem still after Election Day for the Republicans? This and Tell Me a Story today on Backroom Politics. And we're back here live at Shelley's Back Room here in the great city of Washington, D.C., your nation's capital. This is Blog Talk Radio's Backroom Politics. And joining me as they do every Tuesday, to my left, he is the former representative representing Washington's 2nd Congressional District. He is the former Vice President of Government Affairs for Burlington Northern Railroad. He is the Honorable Congressman Al Swift. Hello, Al.
Hello.
Yeah, we're not used to being live after the past few weeks. This is nice.
That's right.
And we're back smoking and drinking. It's a good thing.
It's a great thing.
It is a good thing. To my 11 o'clock, as he is every Tuesday, he is the former Undersecretary of Commerce. He served under, last count, 4 presidents, longtime Senate staffer, longtime Washington insider, and a very handsome fellow from the Stimson Center. He is the Honorable Alan Moore. Hi, Alan.
Hello, Justin.
Welcome back alive.
Nice to be alive.
It is nice to be alive. And directly across the table from me, as he is every Tuesday, he is the former floor chief for then Congressman Gerald Ford. He is the former vice president of government affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Hello, Bob.
Good afternoon, Justin.
And for those of you who are playing the Backroom Politics and Hello Bob game, you take a shot now. And to my right, he is longtime Washington insider and lobbyist and former executive director of the Democratic Party of the great state of Maryland. He is Carl Tuvin. Hello, Carl.
Hello. Hello.
It is good to be back at Shelley's. Lots of stuff to talk about today. But we want to start off quickly with the breaking news coming out of Michigan. As of this afternoon, the state legislature, the House in Michigan, the Michigan State House, passed 2 bills that were previously approved by the Michigan State Senate and has sent these 2 pieces of legislation to the governor's desk for signing, making essentially, short of a complete and total loss of consciousness, Michigan will become the 24th state to invoke right to work. As such, Governor Rick Snyder, Republican out of Michigan, has said that this is a great thing for the economy of Michigan. It is a right thing to do. It does, in fact, go after both public and some private unions on both pieces of legislature going to his desk from the House today. I can tell you right now that many unions, including the UAW, the Teamsters, the American Federation of Teachers, SEIU, AFSCME, all your major unions showed up on force, as well as supporters of Governor Snyder and the legislature, Tea Party-backed protesters, showed up yesterday in what can be said a mass gathering outside the state capitol in Lansing. It is a huge, huge blow to the Democrats, a huge blow to labor unions. But let's get to the bottom of this. First of all, Bob, why is this a victory for, let's say, Governor Snyder and the state of Michigan?
I think it's a plus for the governor and for any governor to be able to have more freedom with respect to employment rights and rights and everything else with respect to public employees. He now does, and it's a big plus whether you're Republican or Democrat, it's good to be able to manage more of what you've got to manage. Is running something as big as a state.
Alan,
a big industrial state.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. But also a very big state with big union presence. I mean, the UAW is huge there. The Teamsters are huge there. Michigan being the home state of Teamster president James B. Hoffa. So that's got to be, I mean, that's in union backyard.
Well, remember this about it. The reason this happened is because the unions, a year ago, tried to get into the get a constitutional amendment guaranteeing union rights and protections, and it went down in a vote.
The infamous card check bill.
It went down by a 2-1 margin, which in effect told the more conservative interest in the state, you know, by God, these guys have overstepped themselves.
But Alan, I mean, we've seen a victory with now Governor Rick Snyder. This is coming on the heels of a huge victory for Governor Scott Walker and the Wisconsin legislation. Is this going to be the new norm? Are we going to see more states trying to invoke right to work?
That's a good question. I don't know about whether this is the front end of something or the middle piece of a movement. It does remind us of a couple of things. Elections matter. And when you've got one-party rule in the legislature and in the governor's office, things can happen. It is also a reminder of the decline, the further evidence of the decline of organized labor. And it's also a reminder that Michigan itself is in deep, deep trouble. You talk about how big the unions are. Well, they're not as big as they used to be because they don't have as many employees as they used to be, as many members as they used to have. And if they want to compete for new factories or expansions in existing factories, they are competing against states that have skilled labor and right-to-work laws. And so there's a little bit of a, we need to stay competitive in this. But this is a big deal.
But Congressman Al, I mean, you've served as a Democratic member of Congress for a number of years. You've been around the Democratic Party. You've been exposed and had interaction with a lot of these unions. Going off of what Alan's saying, do you view this as, in fact, the demise of the power politically that the unions have today, not only here in Washington, but at the state legislative level?
No, I think that's extreme, but let's go back. I've been saying for 30 years that the unions needed to change their image considerably. They've been playing their game like Samuel Gompers for too long. They allowed silly things like one guy could pull the wire across the floor, and then a guy from another union had to come and stick it into the wall. You know, that kind of nonsense began to sour the public on unions a long time ago. And that takes away from the real purpose of unions. I'm a great free enterpriser, and I have always felt that organized labor was the way the working person got a piece of the free enterprise system. I still think that, but I think the unions have played their public relations badly for so long and so badly that this day was inevitable, and they're going to have to change the image of labor if they're going to make a comeback.
And by the way, if you want to join the conversation, for those listening out there in Radio Land, you can call in toll-free at 877-662-3713. Again, that number is 877-662-3713. We'll pick the dime up on that one. But Carl Toobin, back to you. There are a lot of folks that have said that the unions themselves, they made concessions during the auto bailouts, which they were, depending on who you ask, instrumental in keeping Chrysler and GM afloat. There have been other unions, such as the firefighters, the police unions, the laborers, that have gone to work in places like New York, New Jersey, even in places like Wisconsin, Illinois, Michigan, where they've conceded some of the hurt back to them. Is it unfair to say that unions, in fact, are the reason that places like Michigan are feeling a financial pinch?
I don't think so. And I'll make a prediction here today on the 11th of December, about 4:09, that I think in 2 years, the governor of Michigan will change. It'll be a Democrat, and very good chance that the legislature will become Democrat, and this could possibly be overturned. I think that it might have been a reaction to what the unions tried to do in the constitutional amendment, which is not right, but I think that the unions and others are going to unite together and right this wrong as far as the unions are concerned.
Bob Hines.
You know, what's interesting is that the governor, the legislation that was passed, exempted the police and the fire departments, two unions that I think are most highly held in respect by the average American citizen.
Right.
And it's interesting. So in Michigan, the governor was smart enough to do what John Kasich did not do in Ohio.
What's that?
Years ago. When Kasich tried to do much the same thing that was going on in Wisconsin, he included the fire and police, and he lost big. But the governor of Michigan learned a lesson, and he said, in effect, those safety and security people are not going to be affected, and I think that was probably one of the reasons that he was able to get it past the legislature.
But Alan Moore, I mean, even though separating out the FOP, PBA, and the IAFF, which are the large police and firefighters unions, you're leaving out Teamsters, laborers. These are people that get your supplies to the market. These are people that are building the roads and creating a lot of the infrastructure. Is there a little bit of piecemealing going on here?
Sure, there is. I think I would see it slightly different from Bob when he said that those unions are popular. It's not those unions that are popular. It's those members that are popular, and you don't want to get crossways with the police or the firemen. It happens to be over unions. You don't want to get crossways with them on anything because they are perceived as true public servants in ways that the rest of public and certainly private employees are not. So I think the idea was, let's go a little bit piecemeal. Let's wall off this group because we don't want them in this fight. And even if they speak up, they're going to speak up with less enthusiasm and distress.
But Congressman Al.
Yeah.
By piecemealing it, though, I mean, you're creating almost an internal divide and putting almost the legislation at risk should there be a change of power. You've got other public employees that may resent the fact that cops and firefighters can collectively bargain.
Of course.
But laborers can't.
Yes, but the labor movement has got to pull itself back together and reform itself. Let me tell you a story. The machinists union had all of the machinists at Boeing out in Everett when I was in Congress, believing that the moment NAFTA passed, Boeing would move the plant to Mexico. And these are guys I used to drink beer with. They were friends of mine, and I could sit down and talk with them, and I could tell they were really scared. They weren't doing BS, but they were believing BS that was coming out of Washington, D.C. And I ended up voting for NAFTA. Lost a lot of friends doing that. But Boeing isn't building any planes in Mexico. That happened a long time ago.
But wait a minute.
I once asked Boeing what it would cost to move the plant. They said $11 billion, and then we wouldn't have any skilled labor.
Yeah, but let me go back to that, though, Congressman Al. I mean, because what Boeing did, in fact, do was move a good part of their aircraft manufacturing operation out of Seattle to South Carolina. That caused a huge fight. Boeing... Congressman, or I'm sorry, Bob Hines.
They didn't move anything. They added something new.
Well, it depends on who you talk to.
They didn't lose any jobs in Washington.
But those are jobs that normally had they, you know, with the building of the 787, with the expansion of the 737, those are jobs that normally would have gone into largely Al's old district.
Well, yeah, I agree. That's probably true. But the fact of the matter is, it was a question of cost as much as anything else. You're going into a state that's cheaper to work in South Carolina.
Well, it's a right-to-work state, though.
That's right. The point is a cheaper place to work. If you're trying to build something and you can build it for cheaper, you know, by 20 or 20%, and you can get better labor costs, that's not wrong to go there. It's a question of how you balance these things out. But there, it wouldn't be accurate to say that any job was lost in the state of Washington, as far as I know. But Al would...
Congressman Al, go ahead.
Well, and I don't want to get into the weeds of Washington state politics, but Boeing has been one of those things that people love and hate out there. They love them because they provide jobs and they pay a lot of taxes. They hate them because they demand a lot in return from local governments and others. I think Boeing had other reasons that it didn't want to get too much of its total operation in Washington.
But Congressman, now could the argument be made that the reason why they made such a significant move to South Carolina, which in fact had to, they had to bring in the National Labor Relations Board. The reason why they did make that move was largely in part that a large number of those jobs were going to be union-based.
It would be foolish to assume that the fact that they went to a right-to-work state had no effect on the Boeing's decision. Clearly, it did. I was just suggesting that it wasn't the only reason involved.
Alan Moore, you look like you're pondering this.
Boeing relies on union labor,
but they are
in many ways linked at the hip with their unions. However, they also have a great interest, as Al and Bob have said, in spreading the wealth around, not being tied to one place, pitting states against each other. It wasn't just the labor cost or the work rules in South Carolina. It's, hey, we're going to build a new fabrication facility. Let's talk to different states and see what they'll put on the table. So there was a whole lot more than just whether it was likely to be unionized or a right-to-work state or the extent of the skilled labor. There was the whole package, along with Boeing's interest in operating in as many states and congressional districts as it can to have as many friends in Congress as it can.
But let's look at the auto industry though for a second though, Alan. You look at Volkswagen building outside Chattanooga, Tennessee. You look at Honda building a large facility in South Carolina. Toyota, BMW building in Alabama. These are significant states, largely right to work, that, you know, you have, for example, they could have put their plant with economic development money in Michigan, but there's union labor there. Is that a factor, you think, of them making that decision to move down there? And, I mean, you've got a tremendous amount of skilled labor, UAW members in Michigan right now that are somewhat unemployed or underemployed.
Well, when these decisions on building these plants, though, by largely the Japanese manufacturers and to some extent the Germans, there was not a lot of excess skilled labor in Michigan at the time. Now, just because there's skilled labor there doesn't mean, well, I don't know who's building anything new these days, but it's, again, the whole package that these states have to offer. Do they have the kind of skilled labor we need? What are they willing to provide in terms of tax benefits, land, et cetera? And what are the rules under which they're going to work? Is it right to work? If it's all right to work states aren't equal, all non-right to work states are equal. If you go to a place like Detroit, you're going to have to do contracts that fit what Detroit historically has done. That's the kind of work rules that Al's talking about. Good luck if you don't do that. Those are fights that those companies didn't need. They had very, very attractive packages in multiple states, which is why you see factories not all in one, but all around in the right to work.
Bob Hines.
I want to pick up on the point that Alan's making. You know, before all these Japanese plants and some German auto plants are being built in the South, remind yourself that about 10 or 12 years ago, about 12, 15 years ago, up in northern Ohio, there was a huge influx of Toyota and I think there's a Volkswagen plant up there. That northeastern part, northeastern along the river from Toledo all the way over to Cleveland, there are almost every place you look, there are union jobs in Ohio plants. And they were built there because Ohio, as Alan said, these companies were looking for where are they going to go. In Ohio, which had a lot of people, the rubber industry was moving and they had a lot of skilled labor, they found ways to encourage these companies to choose Ohio rather than going south. Now, since then, a lot of companies have been going south more than they have staying around there. But Ohio has made a real big effort and has been very successful in opening plants in the last decade and a half up along the lakes.
Now, let's talk a little bit, because we've been talking about the private sector impact that this legislation is going to have on industries like the auto workers in particular. But let's look at the public sector now, though. I mean, you're talking about a state that has a deteriorating infrastructure in highways, bridges, et cetera. You have a state that's also hurting economically. Does it make sense to go to a right-to-work and just to allow everybody have contractor management free-for-all versus having labor having skin in the game? Does it make sense at that point, Bob, particularly in Michigan?
Sure it does. But, in fact, Michigan has got substantial economic problems, as we all know. I mean, look, Detroit apparently is about half the city that they're just bulldozing because, nobody's living
and
there.
And now the guys who are operating the bulldozers can go car check free.
but the fact of the matter is, Michigan has an unfortunate situation that their entire industrial base was tied around one industry, and when that industry went into the toilet, the state went into the toilet, and it's hard to get out. And the fact that the Obama administration saved the car industry up there, it was very good they had to do that.
Right.
I think a Republican administration might have done it differently, but they would have had to do the same thing one way or another.
Gunger.
You can't let the whole damn industry in the Midwest, the most important building, state building autos in the country, disappear.
Congressman Al.
It reminds me that Boeing went through, this goes back to the idea of does Washington State want to lose Boeing or have more Boeing. Boeing went through a very, very difficult period some 20, 30 years ago, and there was a billboard that said, will the last Boeing employee turn out the lights? The economy was overbalanced on Boeing, and I'm not sure that economists in Washington State would object to it opening plants elsewhere. Organized labor clearly would.
Yeah, but Al, let's look at the public sector, though, for example. You look at for example, a study was done when the state of New York was looking to rebuild the Tappan Zee Bridge, which crosses the Hudson between Westchester and the other side of the Hudson into upstate New York. The costs associated with, and you're talking billions of dollars to rebuild a bridge in New York crossing the Hudson, a significant amount of that cost was based on labor costs, obviously. In study after study, there are many people that call out the fact that if it was a right-to-work state, you could reduce costs by, in some instances, 30%. Is that logical? I mean, does that make sense to go right-to-work at that point for public employees?
It's logical in the sense that you save money that way. How do you save money? You take it out of the paychecks of workers. And what does that do to the economy of your state? What does that do to the economy of the state? I mean, you're not paying it out here, but you're not getting the taxes out of those people, and in worst cases, you're creating welfare and that kind of thing. So I think it's a it's more an ideological fight than an economic fight.
Well, actually, before you go to that, Alan Moore, I want to go to you, and then I'll go to you, Bob Hines. Al brought up a good point. I mean, is going right to work, is that in fact now corporate welfare?
Is it corporate welfare? I mean, I suppose in the eyes of unions who feel entitled to prior laws, they'd say you're bending the rules now in favor of a different set of interests. I was intrigued with Al's notion that if you can save a bunch of money, you save it at the expense of workers who would get it, without any consideration of where the money comes from in the first place to pay for all those salaries, which in the case of public employees is taxes. So, you know, there's no free lunch here. What you're trying to do is do the greatest good for the greatest number, and sometimes that means changing long-time practices. And it's a wrenching process because there are winners and there are losers every time you make changes like that.
Yeah. I keep wondering how the marketplace is going to handle this. I mean, let's go back to George Pullman, one of the guys that really fostered the union movement because he treated his employees so badly. It was just awful what he was doing. The Russian gulag wasn't much worse. Now, is it going to be that we have a whole bunch of enlightened leaders in business now, so that once you have weakened the unions to a certain point, they will not return to the low wage, poor safety, you know, all of those kinds of things, or not? If they could guarantee you that the worker will be just as well off without the union, if they could guarantee that, it would put guys like me in a hell of a position to defend them. But I don't believe for a moment that they are going to do that and advocate it.
Bob Hines.
Al made a good point when he mentioned George Pullman. It was people like that gave rise to the strength of the union system. Now, you know, it's what almost inevitably it is human nature that when your economic interest or political power interest is in, you overreach, and that gives your opponent, who you have maybe you have bested him at this particular point, give him enough time, you overreach, and he can build up, and then you're in the box, so to speak.
Yeah.
This is just what we're going through right now. If the Republican governors and legislatures overreach in the way they treat their public employee unions membership and start impinging on what they consider to be reasonable rights, you know, and the voters will make that decision. But if they overreach, what will happen to them is just what happened to Kasich, Governor Kasich in Ohio a couple year and a half ago, after he saw how Governor Scott in Wisconsin had moved, he decided to go even farther. And he did what he wanted to change the union structures. He included the police and the firemen, and he got killed. He tried to overreach. It balances itself out.
The unions are in the trouble that they're in today, in my judgment, because they overreached in a variety of ways. And it's taken a long time for this to catch up. But one thing I've noticed in this town, the pendulum never stops in the middle.
Well, let me ask Carl.
It swings from one side to the other and then goes back.
Well, let me interrupt you real quick, Congressman. I want to go to Carl Toobin. Carl Toobin, and I'm going to give you the last word, 30 seconds. Is there a common ground that the unions and the state legislatures are going to be able to find in all of this across the board?
I think that the state legislatures are probably alienating the unions, and it's going to be a fight between the two of them. The other thing I wanted to say about Al's comment, hopefully there are laws on the books that can be upheld that for the safety of employees and for the safety of both sides, and that we won't have people going off the edge and stop enforcing laws and doing other things.
I want to let that. I won't let that be the last word. When we come back, we're going to talk financial dilemma, fiscal cliff, sequestration, whatever you want to call it. I'll tell you right now, Boehner and Obama are doing a good impression of Thelma and Louise going over that cliff in that Mustang. Hey, by the way, you can still call in 877-662-3713. Again, 877-662-3713. Call in toll free. The lines are open. We'll be back in 3 minutes. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., on Blog Talk Radio. Stay with us.
Wow, a little bit of Fats Waller, Lulu back in town. And I tell you, when I am back in town, or when any of my friends are back in town, or heck, when we're living here in town, we usually find ourselves down at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., right across from the National Press Club. Why do we come here? Well, they've got the city's best cigar menu, the most diversified, with some of the best-known brands and some that you might even know, but you might want to give it a try. Everything from Arturo Fuentes down to Zeno. You can go all the way from your $9 little petite girly flavored cigars all the way up to the Opus X Lost City. They have a cigar for everybody. Mild, medium, strong, heavy. However you want to smoke it, it's available here at Shelley's Back Room. Come in, have Bob, Na, or any one of the girls show you what the right cigar might be for your taste that evening. Again, Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. As Bob likes to put it, it is definitely the place to be.
You can tell the mailman not to call. I ain't coming home until the fall. And again, I might not get back home at all. Lulu's back in town, yeah.
Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio, and you can call in. Lines are open, 877-662-3713. Join the conversation. We're going to shift gears right now and talk a little fiscal cliff, financial cliff, sequestration, whatever you want to call it. It seems President Obama and Speaker Boehner are going hand in hand, driving that car straight to the edge. Today, it looks like Speaker John Boehner has been trying to shift the argument from raising taxes to spending cuts. Obama is saying the ball is in the GOP's corner. They've got to actually go ahead and move forward on tax cuts. Just when we think there might be movement, in fact, as late as Monday or Sunday evening, Speaker Boehner was at the White House talking with the president. And they have been trying to hammer out a deal, but there just does not seem to be a deal. That deal seems to be elusive right now. Real quickly, overarching, fiscal cliff sequestration. Is this, in fact, Congressman Al, about raising taxes, or is it, in fact, as the president is saying, or is it, in fact, as Speaker Boehner is saying, spending cuts?
Well, it's about both. And I have not understood why the Republicans have insisted that they can't raise taxes. I think they're going to be spending cuts. Without question, there's going to be spending cuts. What they will be remains to be seen, but it's got to happen. But you also have to have more revenue. And the Republicans are absolutely adamant against that. Most Republicans, there have been some ones that have changed their minds. And that seems to me to be the big hiccup that keeps us from moving on. Their opposition to any kind of tax increase.
Alan Moore, you look like you've got a response to that.
I'm thinking.
I would be surprised if
Al,
he didn't.
Where have you been since the election? The Republicans, numerous Republicans, have sort of finally come around to acknowledge, okay, revenue's clearly got to be on the table. The Speaker put the number $800 billion on the table. And
the president
has oddly and curiously, unfortunately, seemed to be where you are, which is pre-election. He's going out around the country and talking about Republicans with a lump of coal and acting like Scrooge, when what we need is what was missing from both sides. We've talked about this around this table. The fact that, folks, we are all in this together. We need revenue. We need spending cuts. We need some of everything. We need to join hands, jump off the cliff together for the good of the order. And that message has not been out there.
Well, Carl,
even though concessions have been made by individuals, it's that bigger message that has been messaged.
Well,
but you said lots and lots and lots of Republicans have done that. Actually, a few Republicans have given on taxes.
Alan Moore, you want to respond to that?
It's what's new is there have been a number. We can talk about how many. I don't think I said lots and lots. Lots and lots would be an exaggeration. But key Republicans, including in the House, have said we need to talk about this. The only good thing in the last few days is these two guys had a meeting on Sunday, and nobody talked about what came out of that meeting. They came out with the same
thing. They have been surprisingly tight-lipped about that.
That was the biggest positive development in the last several weeks.
Well, let me go to Carl Tooven. Carl, I mean, there is the big question of where are the cuts that the Republicans, you know, Obama basically came out and as early as today, and Boehner said, where are Obama's cuts? He's talking about raising taxes. Where are the cuts that the Democrats want to see?
I think Dick Durbin and others have made a claim that everything is on the table. Entitlements are on the table, and all that is on the table. You can't do everything.
But where are the specifics, Carl? Because I want to hold everybody around the table to spit. Where are the cuts? Where are Obama's cuts coming in?
I think it's going to be entitlement. I think it's going to be in the department, but not as it's not going to be sequestration. They've already cut a lot of money from the Department of Defense, and they've cut other agencies and departments, and they're willing to do more, and they're willing to talk about entitlement.
Bob Hines.
Democrats to cut defense, they like to, but they haven't. I haven't seen anything that indicates that any senior Democrats or the administration or the White House or anybody else is saying we will do this on entitlements yet. Now, it may well be that the president is talking about some things that we haven't heard. We have heard that in a conversation about taxes, it appears that the president is saying, well, I could maybe take a little bit less than 39.6. If the Republicans could come up toward 30, some other, they haven't said another number, but you're talking about somewhere in the 37.5 or somewhere range like that. Now, that's the kind of move on the part of both parties, one party moving up, one party moving down to find a solution. With respect to the entitlements, it ought to be possible to find both parties doing much the same thing as they apparently are doing about the numbers on revenue, and that is to find a way to move a little bit toward what the Republicans want and a little bit away from what the Democrats would like and find a deal there. But we apparently have not yet been able to find that approach yet. It looks like on the revenue side, they have talked about something that everything else falling together, they could do.
But Alan Moore, I want to go to something that Nancy Pelosi said on the floor yesterday, and her quote, which we're getting courtesy of our friends over at Politico, her comment is, what stands in the way of inaction on the part of the Republican majority to bring the middle income tax cut to the floor of the House, which across the country has almost universal support, and which I think in this body, meaning the House, given the right to vote for it, would have overwhelming support, unquote. Does she have a leg to stand on there?
Well, here's the problem. Yes, of course. If you brought the Senate passed bill to the House of Representatives, the Democrats would overwhelmingly support it. The Republicans, in the absence of anything else to be associated with it, would be overwhelmingly opposed to it. They say, we can swallow higher taxes on the wealthy, but in exchange for that, we need to have, as part of the deal, some significant spending cuts. I give both Boehner and the president a pass for not being overly specific on what they would cut, because the moment you get real specific, you open up all the lines of attack. The way you do that is you say, here's the spending ceiling that we will agree to, and we will order our committees to figure out the details.
But Nancy Pelosi also said and told Speaker Boehner on the floor of the House, quote, where are the cuts? They're in the bills that you, Mr. Speaker, have voted for. Is she right in that?
I don't know what she's talking about there. I didn't see that line. Obviously, there have been a variety of votes over the course of the last couple of years that assumed a lot of different spending reductions. The thing is, you need to link these inextricably together and move them forward together. It would be lovely if we could get a detailed proposal over here and a detailed proposal over here. It won't happen because the details will be attacked. You have to ride together.
Congressman Al.
Just, and I'm being redundant, but we've been saying for months and months that they've got to jump into this cold pool of water together. And I don't know this, but it's possible that Boehner and the president have been talking some specifics, and they would like to reveal those more or less, you know, so that both the Republicans and Democrats get the backlash from, because there certainly will be one.
But, I mean, Carl Toobin, you're talking, there's a huge gap between the White House proposal of $1.4 trillion and the $800 billion that the Republicans are coming back with. They're saying that everything is on the table. It does not make America feel comfortable. How do they get over that?
Well, it doesn't make the Republicans feel comfortable.
Apparently it doesn't make Democrats feel comfortable either.
Well, you know, it's the minority leader that doesn't feel comfortable. I think others do feel comfortable. And I think that because of the fact that the president, because of being redundant, because of what was said, about the fact that they came out with the press release saying the same things, means that they are working together on something, and they have their staffs working together on something. And if they, you know, if these things got out, all of a sudden the Tea Party would be yelling at Boehner, and this would be yelling at Boehner, and that would be yelling at the president. Let them do their work and come out with something that hopefully everyone will be. Not everyone will be happy with. It's something that works.
Now, breaking news coming out of our friends at Politico, coming off the Hill. Apparently, the GOP has sent another counteroffer as of roughly late this afternoon back to the White House to counteroffer the $1.4 trillion that Obama put on the table on Sunday. Does that give you a sign of hope that we might be getting closer and closer, Congressman Al?
Yeah, I think any movement is encouraging. I don't know what exactly is in those cuts and so forth and so on, but I think getting movement out of the Republicans is close to miraculous, and I applaud it.
But Alan Moore, go ahead. I'll let you.
I was just going to remind us all that a little over a year ago, the president and Speaker Boehner came fairly close to a so-called grand bargain deal that no one knew much about. And it would have had about $800 billion in revenue and about double that number in long-time spending savings. We talk about cuts, and it's important to remember that usually the cuts mean that programs won't grow as fast as they otherwise would have, and we call those cuts rather than savings over the baseline. But they were they came pretty close. I'm thinking that Speaker Boehner has kicked himself numerous times for not cutting the deal at the time, and I'm guessing that the president has kicked himself a few times for changing the ground rules right at the end when they seem to be getting close. But these guys have talked big before, and there is a bit of a template without a lot of detail even then, but in big broad strokes about what they could agree to. And my guess is that that's what they're talking about behind the scenes is sort of a jumping off point.
But Congressman, now going off what Al was saying, there is the impression, however, I mean, we're talking about the golf course deal of last year where this possibly could have been averted. It seems like in the GOP that the president is, using a political insider term, slow walking this deal. Is that a fair assessment?
I don't think that's a fair assessment.
Why not?
Well, I think what he's trying to do is to reach agreement, and he's not the only one walking. And Mr. Boehner is walking. Mr. Boehner has got a tough row to hoe. He's still got the Tea Party back there, many of whom are totally unreformed by the election in terms of what they think is the art of the possible. And Boehner has got to be very careful how he handles it. And so I think he's slow walking, and the president is walking slowly because he doesn't want to get way ahead of Mr. Boehner.
You're saying basically the president's just keeping pace with the Republican?
Yeah.
Bob Hines.
They both have to walk slow and quietly, and they're both doing that. A week or so ago, the president, had a proposal. Boehner talks about, he was saying maybe we can change the how much revenue we raise. Boehner thinks about that. He's got to find a way to, he's got to find a way to say to his people, and he has talked to them apparently, hey, look, the president is willing to take less revenue. Now, we have to be willing to raise, to say, okay, you can raise revenue. And I don't mean just revenue, you can raise taxes. And we're going to have to say something that's very hard for us to say. Do we want to do it? But we have to see what we can get. So they go on. They're having more conversations. If they are talking about some kind of a program that will guarantee reductions in cost of programs over years. I mean, we're not going to change the age of Social Security from 67 to. Or 66 to 70 tomorrow, but over some years maybe. There's things we can do. And when they can agree to something, if they can, there's only two people who have to jump off the cliff hand in hand, and it's the president and the speaker. And if they're both willing to jump off the cliff together with a program they can agree upon, then the crazy tea parties and the outrageously difficult people like Pelosi are going to have to get out of the way.
But
hopefully, they'll be able to be pushed out of the way by more sensible people.
But Carl Toobin, we've talked about Boehner and we've talked about the president. The two people we have not talked about are Mitch McConnell and Harry Reid. What is their plan in this?
Well, McConnell is very scared because he doesn't want a Tea Party opponent in the primary in 2014. So he's kind of, President puts out a proposal, and he sits there and laughs. That doesn't do any good. That is not positive. Harry Reid will go along with what the president wants, and he will take that to the Senate. And
Alan Moore, you spent a lot of time in the Senate. I mean, saying that the majority leader and the minority leader in the U.S. Senate are just going to go along hand in hand, party line. Is that accurate?
Well, it's not as though they're potted plants in this, but they simply don't have the same stature in the conversation as the Speaker and the President. It's those two who have to make the deal. There are enough Republicans in the Senate who have signaled their willingness and openness to step outside the boundaries that sort of emerged in this election. The real question is, what can Boehner sell to his people? If he can sell it to his people, believe me, there won't be a problem selling it to Republicans in the Senate. And if Obama is willing to go along, the Democrats, they'll hold their nose and go along. What you don't want is a deal where one side clearly is able to say, we won that one. They both want to be able to say, we held firm, we got the best deal possible, and let's hope that the country...
Bob Hines.
Just follow up on what Carl said about the problems that the minority leader in the Senate has, because he had a candidate 2 years ago for the open seat in the Senate, and it was not the guy who won, which was Ron Paul's son. What's his name?
Rand Paul. Senator Rand Paul.
So there's not a whole lot of good blood right there, and obviously Rand Paul is going to try to find somebody to run against McConnell if he can in the primary. But the fact of the matter is, McConnell is never going to be up one saying, I got the flag and I'm waving the flag for this wonderful deal. If I would see his progress as this thing goes forward, if it does, if the deal can be made by the President and the Speaker, I see that the minority leader in the Senate is going to release all his senators to do what they think is right, and he may not be able to vote for the deal in order to protect himself. I think that may be where it ends up.
Alan Moore.
Yeah, just a couple of little thoughts there. One, I disagree with my friend about Rand Paul being a problem for McConnell. Yes, McConnell supported a different man. Paul won. The moment he was elected, McConnell became his chief mentor, brought him under his wing, gave him good, to the extent that he could, gave him good committee assignments and other things. I don't think that Paul is going to be in any way leading to find somebody that will take on McConnell. I think he's now become a fan of Mitch McConnell.
Carl Toobin.
Don't worry about that.
Just add to the fact that McConnell has picked Rand Paul's campaign manager to be his campaign manager in 2014 election.
Good point. One of the things we also have to look at, Congressman Al, is, you're seeing right now a Republican Party, and we're going to talk about this later in the show. Guys, show going on. Just wanted to let you know, we got a hot mic. I hope I'm not interrupting anything. My God.
Please, let us talk.
Actually, can I continue?
You are interrupting.
Yeah, obviously. Can I continue? Can I continue? Former member of Congress here.
I point out he's a former member.
He wasn't listening.
Low blow.
They got a point. Congressman Al, what we're seeing right now is we're seeing, and we're going to talk about this after the at top of the hour, a segmented GOP. We're seeing a lot of coalescing, but a little bit of fracturing in the Democratic side as well. Is that going to be a problem getting a final deal through? Is there enough coalition in the House to push a deal without getting the Tea Party or the far left having them have a stroke?
You're talking about a coalition among the Democrats?
Among the Democrats.
My view is that if the president makes a decision and is enthusiastic about it, and if he works the House hard, a la Lyndon Johnson and Bill Clinton. Clinton and what have you. I don't think it's an automatic, but I think if you get a lot of phone calls from the president, the Democrats will go along.
Bob Hines, does Speaker Boehner have the stroke regained enough to get everybody, including Majority Leader Eric Cantor and Tea Party back people, in line on this?
He won't get everybody. That's sure, because I'm sure some of the Tea Party people are not willing to do anything.
Can he get enough to get this deal through?
Let me put it this way. I believe he can, and he and Cantor are getting along better than they did before, much better. And I think Cantor sees that if he were to, you know, organize the Tea Party against the Speaker, he would fundamentally destroy the House of Representatives and Republican majority. And I don't think that would do him any good either, because he would not become the Speaker, because the House would fall apart, and he the whole thing would just be a disaster.
Alan Moore.
Yeah, there's nothing like getting your butt handed to you on a metal plate to focus your attention, and that's what's happening, I think, with the Republicans. Like, we lost significantly at a time where we thought we were going to gain some things. We are clearly doing some things wrong. We have got to modify what we're doing. So I think that has played a role in bringing these guys together.
Well, hold that thought, because I want to come back to that after the top of the hour.
Right. Well, let me just say one thing about what Boehner needs, his challenge. He doesn't need all of his people. He needs a majority of his people. He has made it a principle of governing that any bill that doesn't have at least a majority of Republicans, he will not bring to the full House of Representatives. He does not want major legislation to be passed with a huge majority of Democrats and a minority of Republicans. So he has got to keep a majority of his side together, and then it gives him some freedom to cut a bigger deal that has a lot of Democrats.
All right, that's a good lead into our next segment, because we're going to talk about the problems that the GOP are having internally. A lot of infighting, a lot of changes going on, and with the loss of a lot of old school politicos now leaving the GOP in Congress, this could be an interesting 113th Congress. With that, we're going to take our break. It's top of the hour. It's happy hour here at Shelley's, so that means we're going to order our drinks, cut our cigars, burn them. We're live here at Shelley's Backroom. By the way, Shelley's Backroom, if you come down to Shelley's Backroom and you give them a business card, they are doing a drawing right now for a free year of humidor here at Shelley's, which is a really nice, nice kind of piece of Washington bling, if you will, to have here in town.
$700.
$800 value, at least, here at Shelley's. Come on down to Shelley's, put in your business card. They're going to raffle that off. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 4 minutes. Stay with us.
You know, here on Backroom Politics, you hear us order drinks during happy hour, the second hour of Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. But what you don't understand is the quality of the drink that we're getting here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Backroom Politics premier sponsor. Hey, you got Dave Hammerly and the bar crew there at Shelley's Back Room that really know how to pour a drink. Whether it's something simple like my on-air Jack Daniels on the rocks with a splash of water, or whether it's something elaborate like what has to be the best martini in the District of Columbia for Congressman Al Swift. Wine selection, scotch selection that will blow your mind. They've got Highland scotches, they've got Isle of Skye scotches, blended, single malt, anything you want. Port wines to go with that great cigar from the great humidor. Down here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Come on down, have a drink, and make some new friends. Or heck, just come on down and listen to Backroom Politics on Tuesdays.
one more time. One more once.
And we're back here live at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. You can join the conversation, 877-662-3713. Again, that number is 877-662-3713. We're going to kind of toke on back on the fiscal cliff, but talk to something that's real relevant in this discussion, and that is the infighting going on in the GOP. Is the GOP, in fact, at a low point in its history in politics? A lot of things happening. You got fiscal cliff. You got a lot of key members leaving, notably Senator Dick Lugar, now departing Congress, the U.S. Senate. Huge losses on the GOP side of good old-fashioned political dealmakers. First of all, let's go to the larger question. Alan Moore, I'll start with you. Is the GOP in deep trouble right now?
They're not in deep trouble. They're in trouble. They'll sort it out. As Al said, the pendulum swings. They let a huge opportunity slip by, not by total ineptness. You got to give the president and his people credit for running a very effective campaign. The Republicans picked their candidate. He had some strengths. He had some obvious weaknesses, and now we have a result. In the meantime, I think it was obvious, given the losses in both the Senate and the House to the Republicans, that and missed opportunities, that they realized we have got to make some changes, folks. The core of our strength is white folks, and they are declining in size. As older folks, they are they're growing in size, but some of them are also dying off. And the growth in the party, the growth in the country, the dynamism in the country is tended Democratic this year, and the Republicans need to pay some attention to that so that it doesn't become a self-fulfilling prophecy, and they can't recover lost ground.
Bob Hines, as an old white guy member of the GOP,
thank you.
Is the GOP, as largely viewed in this past election and going into the fiscal cliff discussion, the party of old white men?
Well, it is certainly true that as a percentage of the white men population, many more of them at all economic levels are voting for Republicans rather than Democrats. And I think, as Alan says, and I suspect that my Democratic friends would certainly agree, that the Republicans have to rethink how they deal with a number of the problems which they have failed to realize were changing the demographics of the country significantly. It's easy to look back on it and say, well, about 7 or 8 years ago, at least, well, maybe more than that, it was a while back, when George Bush and John McCain and Ted Kennedy had agreed on an immigration bill, and it never passed Congress. And ever since then, significant part of the population, the Republicans are not getting very many Latino votes. And the Latino population, by definition, is not exactly wild-eyed, liberal, crazy bunch of people. They are a pretty conservative, family-oriented folks. And what they really want is an opportunity, just like my great-grandfather came over here, by God. Now, in that day, when you came into the country, they didn't have a bunch of people saying, well, you're an illegal immigrant. They said, come on in, we need workers.
But Bob, I mean, going
they
back,
also had signs, no Irish need apply.
They certainly did.
That's true, they did.
They
but Bob,
recently is this generation, is this century, and I've talked about it before, but the reality is, every generation has to move forward, and you know, we get over those kinds of things, and we're going to have to get over this one.
But Bob, looking at the white guy base, I mean, they definitely did not show up in the election. I mean, we had political theorists coming out and saying, in large part, that the white male over 30 population that needed to vote to secure a GOP win was roughly around 76%. They showed up at only 70%. Big gap as far as voting goes for your base. Is that a sign that we're either losing touch with reality, we being the GOP, or is that a fact that the party hasn't changed with the nations?
Well,
both.
I think both, and it's also, I think our candidate was not, he was clearly, I believe, the strongest candidate we had, but it is also fair to say he did not enthuse voters the way you would like to have your candidate enthuse the party and the independent voters. There wasn't a lot of, boy, I can't wait to get there, get out and vote for Romney, and I want to put a sign in my yard, and I'm going to send him a contribution, and I'm going to go to the rally, you know, downtown. That kind of thing wasn't happening. And I think he hit his high point at the first debate, and if the election was held the next day, he might have gotten a better result. I don't know. But the fact of the matter is, we have got to find ways to, aside from picking candidates, we have to find a way, we have got to find a way to encourage some folks who are not voting for us to see that the Republicans have their interests at heart.
And
right now, we don't seem to have that.
Congressman Al, you said yes.
Yeah.
And when I was asking the question to Bob Hines.
I think the Republican Party in this go-round was just, frankly, stupid. Now, I've seen the Democrats do stupid things, too. I mean, each party has its turn in the barrel. But when the governor of California, I can't remember his name, some time ago, came out against illegal aliens.
You're talking former Governor Wilson.
Yes.
Pete Wilson.
I thought at the time, this is really dumb, because he did it so strongly, and he did it in an insulting way. And I thought that was, and they've continued to do that kind of thing on that issue, and they've continued to do it on some other issues. And all they need to do is sit and say, hey, we need those people, and is there a way we can maintain the loyalty to our principles without having to stick our thumb in the eyes of these people that we need to vote? And I think they haven't thought that part through. How do we get our views through to these people? And it will take some doing, because I think they're kind of knee-jerk anti-doing that kind of thing.
This is just that we have
Bob Hines.
It isn't just that we have to get them to understand our philosophy and principles. We have to sound a little more empathetic to their philosophy, their needs.
You've got to understand them, too, yes.
And I think we have seemed to decide not to pay attention.
But the funny thing about it is, I mean, we alienated members of our own party, Hispanics. There is a coalition of gay Republicans, the Log Cabin Republicans, who basically print money for the party, and they did not come out fully in the election. We alienated them. We alienated black members. We have a number of prominent black members of the party, in people like Herman Cain, J.C. Watts, Michael Steele, and even our freshman, we have a freshman from the Carolinas who is looked at as a large up-and-comer, as a black member of the GOP. But we alienated them. We alienated women, and there are strong women in the party. That is that an internal problem that we just didn't get the message right, or is it the fact that the fringe has taken over? Bob Hines.
Well, I don't think we missed what we need to do. I think there's not a will to do it. That's my feeling. Now, I think maybe it's partly because, you know, the Tea Party has caused a lot of internal, you know, rigmarole within the party. It's causing trouble. But I don't think it's the fact that we don't understand what needs to be done. The will to do it is not there.
But Alan Moore, do you agree with that? That the will's not there?
I don't know about whether the will is there. There's disagreement on what we're saying here. Let's acknowledge that the candidate had some weaknesses, and he wasn't that well known. The president invested an enormous amount of money to define him, and then subsequent events played to some degree into reinforce the definition. We can argue whether the definitions were unfair or not. I think they were, but they were. And then when he came out with his 47% remark, and when he failed to be much more aggressive on issues that are of interest to women, and failed to be more aggressive on the immigration issue, it became a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Alan, you're talking about the presidential election.
That's
But even outside the presidential election, I mean, the GOP should have had 5 Senate seats confirmed, and they lost those in the past 2 years.
Well,
I mean, theoretically, this election for the GOP was an arbitrary bloodbath.
But that was because they got themselves into a situation with this god-awful primary system we have, where some true fringe candidates were elected who, instead of more solid middle ground candidates who almost certainly would have won, but you can't blame some big massive trend for that. Each case is a little bit different. There was this rightward movement. There's no doubt about this. There was this anger about what was going on in the country. That fed into it. We came up with some really weak candidates and missed out on some fabulous opportunities.
Congressman Al's been waiting patiently. Congressman Al.
I think that there is a fundamental problem that can be addressed. Conservatives, by their very nature, tend to be skeptical of things that are new. And they believe that you need to see, is this new idea going to work? What is wrong with it? It's a standard thing, and that's not a critical comment. Conservatives want to approach new ideas and new things carefully so they don't do something stupid. The Democrats, on the other hand, love new things, and they need to be careful that they don't run headlong into some idiotic idea that happens to be currently popular on the left. Given the fact, if what I say about the conservatives is true, that they're skeptical of that which is new, they're entering a period in which there are going to be new things all the time. I mean, the pace of change in this country is picking up enormously. And if the Republicans insist that they have to study something for 20 years before they figure out that they can do it, they're going to have some real problems. They've got to examine what is new and react in some positive way to it, or they're going to end up right where they are right now.
Carl Toobin.
There's something that the Republicans have done, and they don't really evaluate what they've done. After the election, there were rumors that there a few legislatures were going to go in and were going to try to do voter suppression. They didn't learn that part of the reaction to voter suppression in the past election was a tidewater of blacks coming out to vote for President Obama. Governor Jindal
of Louisiana
got very angry last week when Romney made some remarks about, you know, how the president went to different groups of people and paid them to come out and vote on it. And he said, basically, you can't bring those people into the party when you start making, keep making press about them, negative press about them. And the fringe, you're always going to have your fringe candidates on the Republican side.
Well, just as you are on the Democratic side as well. I mean, you guys had a bunch of really interesting characters on the Democratic side that lost.
Quite true, but you got Santorum who's looking at another run for the presidency, and who knows who else is going to be out there doing the same thing. So, the Republicans really, I mean, we've been there. We've had this battle within the Democratic Party.
Absolutely, we'll have it again someday.
We'll have it again someday. The Republicans have to look and evaluate all of that and come up.
Bob Hines.
Maybe to go back to a point that we were talking about our candidate and maybe he wasn't the best one. I disagree with that because he was the best one once. Now, here's the problem that he had. Remind yourself, when he was standing up there with that whole row of candidates early in the primary season, every one of them was to his right. I believe every one of them was to his right. Now, and so for a long time, his problem was to sound like he was, within the reasonable framework of these guys and gals. His problem was that the most activist organized group of people in the Republican Party are pretty darn conservative. They're not all Tea Party, but it's a pretty conservative philosophy, generally speaking. And there's nothing wrong with that. But the idea that it's my way or the highway hurts you terribly, whether you're dealing with a legislative discussion or whether you're running for president. It's awfully hard to stay conservative enough during the early primaries and into the middle primary season so that you're still relevant and somebody doesn't pass you up and keep going. You know, a couple of people passed him up, but they couldn't keep going.
But when you
say the reality is that what happened was by the time he finished to the point where he was going to get the nomination, he had a good bit of garbage he was carrying that he really didn't want to have to carry, and he was never able to. He couldn't walk away from it, and at the same time, he couldn't walk it away from it, and at the same time, keep those folks, committed to him.
Congressman Al.
I would recommend to both parties that they simply do not allow their nominees to be picked in a convention. I think they should have primaries. And the reason I say that is that conventions tend to draw the most militant and often are taken over by the extremes. I remember a convention in Washington State when Henry Scoop Jackson, probably the most popular
political politician
in my state, where we had to adjourn the convention early. I don't know what mechanism they used to do that, but they just said, we're done. Because they were about to endorse not Scoop Jackson, but an ultra way out liberal from the wrong part of the state, who also happened to be black, which wasn't in his favor in our state. Scoop went on to win that election in a legitimate two-party state by 82% of the vote. They were going to dump somebody that popular for somebody that nobody ever heard of.
Bob Hines.
In the convention.
Just two or three weeks ago, in Virginia, the Republican Party decided, the leadership of the party, which is quite conservative, decided that we were not going to have a primary for the governorship.
Correct. Mm-hmm.
We are going to have a convention.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what that meant was that the Attorney General was going to clearly win that by a 2-1 number.
The Republican Attorney General,
Republican
Bob Cuccinelli.
Yes.
Who is, if not extreme, at least very, very far to the right.
He is quite so. And on the other hand, they had a conservative Republican, much like the current governor, who
right.
is the lieutenant governor, who would probably be able to win a primary. He pulled out. He said, "Okay, I'm not even going to try to. I'm not even going to go to. I don't care about the convention. I'm not even running anymore." we are probably going to have a candidate for governor on the Republican ticket who is very, very, very conservative. Now, that may win him an awful lot of votes south of Route 64, which runs through Richmond across the state. But it isn't going to do us any good 30 miles north of that highway. And that's where probably 65% of the population lives. And these are good people who'd like to be voting for Republican, but Cuccinelli is not going to be a candidate who is going to be able to sell.
Well, that brings up a good point, Bob. I mean,
we're committing Harry Caray in a public place.
My point, you should do it by a primary, not a convention.
Well, but wait a minute. But it does show a trend right now, the change to convention from primary in the Commonwealth of Virginia. Reince Priebus, the chairman of the Republican National Committee, announced that there is going to be an official review called a postmortem, a lessons learned that they put together, that they're going to be reviewing this collective of Republican leadership, which includes Jeb Bush, Sally Bradshaw, Ari Fleischer, a very prominent Puerto Rican Republican named Zori Fialdez. It includes Glenn McCall from South Carolina. They are all coming together, and they're all trying to talk about where they went wrong in the campaign, where they went wrong in fundraising, demographics, messaging, outside groups, campaign financing. Is this a sign that the Republican Party is, in fact, literally grabbing for the wall in the deep end, Alan Moore?
We've talked already today about the way the pendulum swings, and
but does this seem drastic?
You know, when there's a death wish by individual states, and that's of course not how they see it. It's going to carry itself out. I wish I thought that primaries were universally going to work, but they are also, on both parties, notoriously vulnerable to
money influence,
very low turnout, the huge influence, the disproportionate influence of money. That's where money can really, really, really
we
make.
We saw
it.
That
as you saw,
as I saw in Oklahoma
up close,
too,
up close in Oklahoma. And what I think we need to do in the Senate and in the House is turn the nominating process over to the five of us, so we can pick the best person to win.
So now you're saying, let me get this straight.
That's a much better idea than mine.
We can save the RNC a lot of time and a lot of headache, and a lot of money by having the five of us sit around, smoke cigars, drink Jack Daniels and martinis, and say, this is who you should pick.
Absolutely. But we will allow people to entertain us, to wine and dine us, to make their case.
I like the idea, as long as it's for both parties, because there are three Republicans, and we can pick the Democratic nominee.
Yeah, but here's the problem, though. They get to pick the Republicans.
That'd be okay, because I cannot imagine Carl and Al wanting, they couldn't even vote for a Tea Party guy in that situation.
Which would, in many instances, not be a bad thing. But here's my question, though. What we're seeing is right now, when you look at the national level, the Republicans have a situation where they feel that they are literally in the deep end trying to hold up water. What we're seeing at the state level, though, we're seeing 60% of the state legislatures and governors are controlled by Republicans. Where's the disconnect, Bob?
Well, the disconnect is that most of those legislatures and governors were elected several years ago when that was an off-year election, and they won, and there wasn't a presidential candidate at the top. And they were running state issues and state stuff, and most of the states were voting Republican. We now have got 29 Republican governors and about the same number of state legislators.
And the Tea Party was just getting started.
Well, no, 2010 was a big year for state legislatures for the Republican Party. But Carl Tubin used to be the executive director of a state party in Maryland. Where is the disconnect between the federal and the state side? Because the Republicans can't seem to do anything wrong at the state level.
Well, you know, the state level seems to be much more conservative than the conservatives here in Washington. And that has marked some pretty bad things happening, as far as I'm concerned, in the state. And I think that that's part of the problem. Again, I go back to voter suppression. They had all this voter suppression on many, many different states, and it boomeranged on us. It wasn't only blacks, it was Latinos, it was Mexican Americans, it was all kinds of people. And I think when that happens, how do you get a hold of that when you have some governors who are very conservative who believe in the same thing? And with regard to your remark about how I trying to pick a president, if we did a broker and we had an agreement with these Tea Party people that they would do what Al and I, some things he said, we might go along with it.
All right. But let's look at this. So it also strikes me that there's news today that since the Supreme Court is going to possibly take up the issue of gay marriage, that in fact a lot of GOP leadership are staying quiet. Is that a sign that we may have seen a crossover, or we may have learned our lesson, Congressman Al?
It's an indication that much to my surprise, Republicans may be able to learn.
Bob Hines.
As far as I'm concerned, I wouldn't mind the Supreme Court taking care of a lot of the social issues and get them out of the political field, because the Republicans are all on the wrong side.
Alan Moore, you want to chime in on that?
I have always felt that the Defense of Marriage Act, which is a federal law, which this White House a couple of years ago decided it wasn't going to defend in court anymore because they felt it was unconstitutional, which was a bizarre decision in its own right. But I've always felt that law was an abomination and cried out for change on a matter of fundamental fairness, and I'm very glad they took that up. I'm less certain that they made the right decision to take up the California Proposition 8 law, and I'm reminded of two different historic precedents. In the 50s, with Brown versus Board of Education, we had a problem of really segregated behavior in this country that screamed injustice, that screamed for change, and even though there were huge regional differences in points of view, the Supreme Court rightly went forward with a very controversial at the time decision and said, this is unconstitutional, we can't do this. I think the dynamic was very different in the 70s with Roe v. Wade, where the states were making change. They were moving along, and I think at that time, at that place, the Supreme Court overreached and suddenly found, mysteriously hidden in the Constitution, this right to an abortion. And the country was moving in that direction. In the case of gay marriage, the country is moving in that direction. And I have this fear that the Supreme Court's going to be caught between sort of a rock and a hard place. If they say, oh yeah, that's been here all along, that is going to outrage a lot of people, even though we're moving in that direction. And if they fail to do that, they will look like they're out of touch with America and uncaring. So DOMA, Defense of Marriage Act, absolutely take it up, throw it out.
You know,
the Proposition 8 and the gay marriage issue, I'm less certain about. We'll see. I wish them well. I happen to support gay marriage myself, but I'm not sure that them taking up that issue at this point in time is the best thing for the court or for the country. Let's see.
But Carl Dubin, go ahead.
Yeah, a lot of talk about Chief Justice Roberts and the fact that he's concerned about his legacy and how he has led the court. And that could be very, very important. The same thing that happened here has happened with health care.
Well, you know, the last point of this, you know, when we look at the people that are on this RNC panel doing the postmortem on the last election, a lot of practical, sensible, I don't want to say middle of the road, but a lot of practical Republicans on that list. But at the same time, there are other organizations. You've got according to our friends at Politico, you've got organizations like Crossroads GPS that are doing their own and other super PAC types that are doing their own postmortem. Is there going to be a conflict, do you think, Alan Moore, between what we're going to see coming out of the RNC postmortem versus what we're going to see out of the super PAC postmortem? And could this be the end of the major super PACs, i.e., the Karl Roves and the Tea Party?
I'm not prepared to announce their demise, having only come into the fore. But I do think that we're going to see a lot more super PAC activity where they can make huge differences. And that is in state and local in state races. That's where you, as we said a little bit earlier, as you witnessed and experienced, where money can really make a difference. In the case of the national election, money here and there and a few Senate races and so on made a bunch of difference, including in some of the primaries. It ultimately didn't make a huge difference. Where $1 billion versus $1 billion in its own kind of odd way made everybody hold their nose, but it didn't have that much impact. So I see some changes coming, but I don't think that they're going away.
Congressman Al, you think this could be the end of the folks like Karl Rove, Crossroads GPS, and the other major super PACs?
We, alas, will always have the Karl Roves. The Democrats will have an equivalent. My concern, as I've expressed in this program before, is that the politicians themselves, the ones who will make the decisions, who are running for election, are letting those people dictate their policy. I don't think it's bad to have somebody who knows how to win an election run your election. I think it's bad for him to tell you how you should run your office, how you should choose your votes. That's where they overstep the line, and the party's got to back them out some way. And I don't think that there is any particular desire in either party to do that. I was going to say that's an evil and that's an overstatement, but that is a wrong way to run a Democratic election.
All right, I'm going to let that be the last word. We're coming up on the bottom of the hour break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about the loss of some thought leadership going on in Congress, the effect that the 113th Congress is going to have with a lot of new faces coming in and how that's going to affect how we govern America. And my favorite part, tell me a story, we'll bleed right into that. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us. Everybody knows Shelley's Backroom for its corporate events, its happy hours, its famous campfire wings and fruit cigars and drinks. But what you didn't know is that Shelley's is open during the weekend, too. In fact, Shelley's Back Room on the weekends even has a non-smoking section. You can bring your family, your kids, enjoy the same campfire wings and same glorious food that you enjoy during the week, but without the famous Shelley's cigar environment. Also, during the weekend, it's football season. That means a lot of the regulars come down and enjoy their drinks and their favorite cigars, all while watching their favorite local teams, whether it's the Ravens, the Redskins, on several HD screens throughout the place. So remember, Shelley's Back Room, it's not just for happy hours anymore. 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., official sponsor of Backroom Politics.
No one to walk with, but I'm happy on the elevation, on the shelf, ain't misbehaving. Saving my love for you, and you, especially you, yeah. I know for certain, the one I love, I'm through with flirting, it's you that I'm thinking of. Ain't misbehaving, saving all my love for you. Like Jack Horner, in a corner, don't go nowhere, what do I care? Your kisses go. I'm home about 8 at my little radio. Hey, misbehaving, saving my love for you, for you, for you, yes, you. All my love for you. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
And we're back here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., for our last and final hour and final segment of the show for this week. We're going to be talking a little bit about the casualty list coming out as we go into the final weeks of the 112th Congress and we look at the 113th Congress. We've lost a lot of thought leadership that are being either retired or unelected. This poses a problem, Alan Moore, as we're seeing a lot of the old school going away and a lot more radical younger crew coming in. Is that something that America should take note of?
You know, I've been watching people I've known and liked lose or leave for when I was in the Senate, when I left the Senate, when I came back to the Senate. It happens. Nobody is indispensable. Having said that, there are always a few. If you have some pet issues, my sort of big pet issue is in the world of global health and global AIDS, and a lot of friends of that issue have gone away. Some new ones have emerged. In the case of foreign affairs, losing Dick Lugar is a big deal. The way we lost him was unfortunate, but he's getting old, and he didn't do all the things that one needs to do to protect himself against a primary opponent and so on. And then the guy who beat him in the primary had some self-inflicted wounds, or he might well have won, and we might have learned whether he had the capacity to grow. He didn't show it as much as many of us would have liked during the election. It just happens, and it's really hard to get caught up and totally lament the loss of people. If you know somebody or feel strongly about a certain set of issues, it's more poignant. But life changes. People move on, and so there was nothing that caused me horrendous pain, just a little touch of sadness here and
but,
there.
But bye-bye.
I agree with Alan. You lose some good people, but you're going to get some people who are going to turn out to be good people. The thing that I think that you lose that is the most valuable is that you lose the experience of negotiating and getting deals done. And I think about it because the longer you're in either body, the more you realize that it isn't going to be your way or the highway if you want to be successful. And so you have to negotiate and work deals. And so we've had such a large influx in the last couple of elections that it is true that we have some really good people on the left and some really good people on the right, but they tend to be more rigid than they might be 10 years from today.
But we're talking about just looking at the Senate, for example. You're looking at just who's retiring. Olympia Snowe, largely looked at as a moderate and a deal maker.
That's a loss.
You're looking at Daniel Akaka of Hawaii on the Democratic side. Joe Lieberman retiring.
That's
is a huge loss.
That's a big loss.
I mean, there are some very significant names. I mean, if you look at the House, agree with them or not, Barney Frank is still a loss. He is old school deal maker.
He's a good legislator.
As was, you look at somebody like Dan Boren on the Democrats, but a Dan Burton from Indiana retiring after 15 terms. Those are large, Gary Ackerman out of New York, large-term members that were part of the deal-making scene. Will we ever be able to regain that type of cross-aisle intimacy? Alan Moore.
Absolutely. I mean, it's not easy, but it still happens. We still muck along, but we function. And the people you've just talked about, one can say, yeah, they're old school. One can also say, they're old. And things do change. The old makes way for the new, sometimes in messy and unfortunate ways, sometimes just because people get old and say, you know, it's now my time to move on, make room for somebody else. Sometimes these elections that bother those of us who think we should have won that one. The Senate race in Delaware is a good example where a Tea Party candidate knocked off an almost certain winner among Republicans, and we ended up with a guy named Chris Coons. He turns out to be a really good guy and a very effective senator. He's, in many ways, he was sort of an accident thanks to Republican shooting each other in an unfortunate way, but we end up with a guy who, from my standpoint, from my vantage point, it turns out to be a pretty interesting and pretty effective guy. So there would be surprises that grow out of this process, and some of the weaker candidates are not going to get reelected. If they are, well, then either they've improved and evolved and matured, or a pox on their voters, and we need to bring it back here to the table for us to make those decisions.
I mean, agreed, but you had something to add in, Carl?
The other thing I was going to say is that sometimes with all these changes, you lose people who have the institutional nerve and possibly haven't taken to give this to other people so that they know these things. It's a new body, it's a new age and everything else, but you're going to have people come in who want to negotiate, who want to get together with the other side and make decisions that are going to move the country forward, and not in the way that we've worked for over the last 4 to 6 years.
Congressman Al.
There's a sense in which we figure that there's nobody going to be as good as the people you've lost. And I remember Senator Magnuson, who was a hero of mine, and he lost in the Reagan election. And he ultimately was replaced by Slade Gorton, who was in Washington State kind of the Richard Nixon in the sense that all Democrats hated him. I ended up working well with him, respected him because he was a senator there for the right reasons, disagreed with him on a lot of politics. He was a good senator. And finally, that seat was taken by Patty Murray. And Patty Murray is now fourth in leadership, and she has been given huge responsibilities by leadership. And so she's now very valuable, and she's talking about retiring. So the ball
line.
Rolls.
For me, I look at it, and it's not, I would like to see lots of Republicans elected, but I also don't mind at all seeing Democrats elected who are the kind of people that we have sitting here among us, some Democrats who are able to negotiate.
Well, I mean, Washington State lost Norm Dix.
Yeah. And, he volunteered to leave, but he
was retiring.
He was a very good congressman. Now, the person who replaced Norm Dix, let's say he, I don't know who it is, let's say he's a fine, fine person. He's probably going to be more liberal than I care about. But if he is the kind of
His name is Derek Kilmer.
And he used to work for Al.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
No, all right, that's it. We're done with this conversation. We've got our answer.
Whether you are a liberal or a conservative, if you grow into the reality that you can't get what you want by just talking to your friends, you got to go across the aisle and cut deals. If you get more people like that coming in, it really doesn't make so much a difference about your personal philosophy. It makes a difference if you're in a majority or minority and you're making deals and both sides are getting something out of it. That's what we need to be doing. And right now we don't have people in the middle who are able to, on both sides of the aisle, work deals out and then go to both of the extremes and say, we got to solve the problem.
And
Congressman Allen.
And I might add that Norm was one of those.
Yep.
And the guy that's replacing him is one of those, as given his history in both the state house and the state senate. He worked across the aisle to get things done, so presumably he will do that here.
And given a few years in election and some little seniority and respect, he's going to be real useful.
That's right.
Is America, I mean, mean, you know, because this obviously this discussion leads into the question of term limits. I don't want to get into term limits, but is America less served by losing some of this gray beard leadership, Congressman Al?
No, I think it's a natural process in democracy, and I'm totally opposed to term limits, because it takes away from the public the right to choose whom they want, and that's the huge thing. But the idea that you're going to have change is something you got to get used to. Hell, that's life.
Well, I want to let that be. I'm going to let that be the last word on this, but obviously 113th Congress, they're coming in January. It's going to be interesting times for all. We're now getting into my favorite part of the segment called Tell Me a Story. We're going to go to that after the break. When we come back, we'll have the final 10 minutes. I'm not giving the call in. It's 10 minutes, and that's Tell Me a Story. I'm not messing with that. We also want to talk about a couple of major losses here in the nation. We'll talk about that when we get back. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
You know, you hear us talk about Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. It's being the place to be. America's premier cigar tavern, place to make new friends or visit old friends, or even have a lively political discussion like we do here on Backroom Politics. But what you may not know, Shelley's is the place for private parties. Shelley's Backroom is available to host events for groups of 10 to 250. From cocktail receptions to sit-down dinners, Shelley's can provide custom menu options to suit your needs and budget. Although Shelley's is a smoke-friendly environment, Shelley's can make accommodations for non-smokers based on the size of your party, but heck, why would you want to? With a cigar menu like they have here, why would you even consider going smoke-free? Event pricing varies based on the time of the day of the week chosen for your event. For more information on private parties at Shelley's Backroom, go to www.shelleysbackroom.com/private-party. Shelley's Backroom, the place to be, as Bob likes to say it. It's also the place for private parties.
In the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. And come to my favorite part of the show. This is Tell Me a Story, where we talk about all the latest innuendo, buzz, rumor that we hear around the Beltway. Congressman Al, I'm going to start off with you. You have Tell Me a Story.
Dave Brubeck died this week, and I interviewed him once years ago when the quartet played a concert in Bellingham, Washington. And during the break, I got a chance to interview him. Now, we've talked about the media a lot, and we think that sometimes the media only distorts politics. I remember saying to Brubeck, such and such a magazine, I can't remember the name of it, has been really hard on you, Blake. They say you pound instead of play and all so forth. And he said, what magazine was it? And I told him, and he said, oh, forget it. They tore George Shearing down in order to build me up. Now they're tearing me down to build somebody else up.
Fickle woman, the media. Alan Moore, tell me a story.
Sure, a couple of quickies. Susan Rice, damaged goods, will not be the next Secretary of State.
Wow.
Jim DeMint, firebrand conservative Republican from South Carolina, is going to leave the Senate to take over the presidency of the conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation. He's a smart guy. He's never been known as a big thinker. So the question is, are they now, is this promotion for him going to take the think out of think tank?
Wow.
And then finally, on the question of immigrants and Republicans and everybody realizing that at a minimum what we need to do is take these foreign kids who come over here and get college or graduate educations, we need to find a way to keep them here, be ready for people to start talking about adding a little tear-off green card to all of their diplomas so they can hang around.
Do we see the DREAM Act pass in 113?
I think so.
Interesting. Bob Hines, tell me a story.
In all the talk about the fiscal cliff, we are missing something that could be even more destructive to comedy in the Senate. On the 3rd of January, when the new members are sworn in and the body organizes, it looks as though the majority leader is going to try and fundamentally change the filibuster, not just requiring people to actually filibuster and speak, but changing the rules with respect to how you can use the filibuster, with respect to motions and things like that, fundamentally changing it. And it's going to be, if he does it, it's going to cause more trouble in the Senate than almost anything you can do. And like most things, it'll probably come back to haunt the Democrats, because when the Republicans get the majority, they'll probably just be as obnoxious as Aaron Reed will be. I hope he doesn't do it. I think it's a mistake. I think the rule needs to be changed. You got to be up, stand up, and talk if you're going to filibuster. But once you stand up and talking, that's enough of a change.
Bring back Jimmy Stewart. We want to go Capra-esque on the filibuster.
Bring back
there we go.
25 hours.
That's true. Carl Tooven, real quick, tell me a story.
I'd vote for Jimmy Stewart.
Real quick, a friend of mine and I about to say thank you. My favorite was the Los Angeles show. There's a lot of stories about the lead actor in the movie. He came to the United States. He went to Indiana. He went to Illinois. He looked at Lincoln. He absorbed Lincoln. And when he walked out on the set, people called him Mr. President. It almost, when you watched that movie, at least when I watched that movie, you almost thought that you were there, the way the whole thing is set up. And frankly, when the 18th Amendment was passed, I got very, very emotional.
Wow.
And then when it was announced that he was shot, I also got very emotional.
Yeah.
It is a terrific movie. That's what...
Quickly.
From what you said, I think that this little group of Republicans that are going to meet is a bad idea. It should be expanded. There should be more people involved as they're probably.
Well, hold that thought. We're going to take that up next week. Hold that thought. Real quickly, two things. Number one, there's two people that are, one is running for office. There's a new name in Republican politics here in Washington, D.C. Ron Phillips, former guy from Florida, is running and looks like a good lead for chairman of the Republican Party of D.C. Now, is it five guys and Ron? Yes, possibly. But he's going to be changing the face of Republican politics in the district. That's number one. Number two, interesting thing coming out of Tennessee. Tennessee Democrats are starting a large-scale recruiting effort to get former actress and daughter of country singer Naomi Judd, Ashley Judd, to run for the U.S. Senate against Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. In Kentucky, Mitch McConnell, it's one of those bluegrass states. They're getting Ashley Judd to run for against Mitch McConnell for his Senate seat in 2014, and apparently this has legs.
She sure does.
Yeah, she does. Have you seen her? She does have nice legs. But
dirty old man.
Yeah.
But it would in a matchup, McConnell Judd McConnell wins 47-43, but keep an eye on that. That's probably going to have.
If he's that high this early. Wow.
And she hasn't even talked about it, but big recruiting effort. So on that note, one last thing. Alan, why don't you touch on this? House lost a longtime member and a longtime deal maker.
Well, Jack Brooks.
Jack Brooks, who served with you, Al.
Served with, and knows.
And I think you worked with him as well, Bob.
Fairly well.
Jack Brooks, you had interaction with him, but Bob, you knew Jack Brooks fairly well.
No, he was an irascible SOB, but he was a very, very good legislator.
He was very effective.
Yeah.
Very effective.
And he had a side to him. We have 30 seconds?
We have 30 seconds.
I have an old Ansonius metal clock. You know, from the 1870s, my great-great-grandmother's. It broke 40 years ago. And I had it in my office in the Capitol because I wanted to see if I could get the Capitol's timekeeper to fix it. Jack Brooks was up testifying, and he saw the clock, and he came over and looked at it. And I had no idea that he knew about clocks. And he said, this is awesome. Can I take this home and work on it? And I said, Mr. Chairman, you damn well please up my clock. He fixed that clock. And I can tell you that every time in the next several years while I was still in the Rules Committee staff, any time he was up there on Judiciary Committee, when he came over, as he walked in, he came into the room, the first thing he did was not say hello to the chairman. He came over to my desk and said, Bob, how's the clock working?
Congressman Al, you actually served with Congressman Brooks.
I did indeed. He was everything, but the thing I most remember about him is I used to put my cigars in my breast pocket, the outside of my coat, and he would inevitably come up to me, take them out of my breast pocket, and put them on the inside pocket.
Now, Jack Brooks was an avid cigar smoker.
Avid cigar smoker, and my maintain is if he was still in Congress, Nancy Pelosi would be allowing cigar smoking in the Congress.
Well, you were lucky that he didn't put two of the cigars in your pocket and keep one for himself.
Yeah, as a fine.
I think the record shows that Jack Brooks cleaned Bob Hines' clock.
Carl Tubin, 10 seconds. Wow. Wow. By the way, 5 points on the clean your clock reference. That was awesome. Bob doesn't get his clock cleaned by just anybody. You have Chairman of Judiciary cleaning your clock.
Anytime you get something like that.
By the way, he did that rhetorically, metaphorically, and literally. That was, yeah. Our thoughts and our prayers go out to Congressman Brooks' family. Obviously, he's a really neat character that's been lost. But on that note, on behalf of Congressman Al, Alan Moore, Bob Hines, Carl Tubin, I am your host, Radio's Justin Russell. I will be back with the rest of the gang next Tuesday with special guests from the Club for Growth. We will be talking about the fiscal cliff again with one of the key players inside the Beltway. Stay tuned for that, but we'll be back live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Bob?
The place to be.
Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next week. Have a great week, everybody. Bye-bye.